Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Saunderson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 17th of July, these are our main stories. Russia has rejected allegations by Western governments that it mounted a campaign of cyber attacks against researchers trying to develop a coronavirus vaccine. The number of coronavirus cases recorded in Brazil has passed 2 million. A court in Saudi Arabia has reportedly ruled that a woman has a right to live alone in a case seen as highly significant in the deeply conservative society. Also in this podcast,
they're calling them campfires, so they are small solar flares dotted around the surface of the sun that we didn't know about before.
Scientists hope that new dramatic images of the sun will help them discover why its outer atmosphere is hotter than its surface. The United States, Canada and Britain have accused hackers linked to the Russian intelligence services of carrying out cyber attacks against those trying to develop a coronavirus vaccine. They complain of an ongoing malicious campaign by a group of hackers known as APT29 or Cozy Bear to steal vaccine research. The UK's National Cyber Security Centre said the hackers almost certainly operated as part of Russian intelligence services. Kieran Martin is the head of the NCSC. He was asked by the BBC if he's confident that organisations in Britain have enough protection.
Well, for several months now, we've been working with universities, pharmaceutical companies, the health service to make sure that the things that our COVID response depends upon have the best protection available. So we've moved several universities and pharmaceutical companies up to the highest level of prioritisation for our support from the National Cybersecurity Centre to their networks. So we watch them actively, we watch the traffic on their networks with their agreement. We show them how to patch, how to make sure that their networks have the most up-to-date protections. So they are receiving much more attention than they used to, and we're as confident as we can be that they're as well protected as they can be. There's no reason to believe at this stage that our ability to produce vaccines has been compromised or that there's been a successful theft of valuable intellectual property. But clearly, this is something that's affected us, it's affected Canada, it's affected the United States, it's probably affected other countries. So we have to be on high alert across the world with our partners about future attacks of this nature.
Kieran Martin. The Kremlin has denied involvement. From Moscow, here's Sarah Rainsford.
Recently, we've been hearing, very recently, about great successes, apparently leaps forward in the science towards developing one specific vaccine that Russia says is proving successful in trials, and talking about potentially creating millions of doses of that vaccine in the months to come. And all the rhetoric is about how Russia wants to share, wants to cooperate with the world in what is a global problem. So the language here is very different, of course, to what we're now hearing in these allegations coming from the US, from Canada and from the UK.
I heard more from our cyber security correspondent, Joe Tidy.
Well, we've known since the beginning of the pandemic that cyber criminals around the world have been using the chaos and confusion and fear around coronavirus to increase their number of cyber attacks against individuals and companies. And since May, we've heard from the likes of the NCSC, the National Cyber Security Centre here in the UK, and also Homeland Security in the US. We've heard from them that these things called APT groups, which stands for Advanced Persistent Threat Groups, who are a group of highly trained, well-funded hackers, usually state-sponsored. We know they've been very active as well. We know they've been attacking particularly medical research centres and even hospitals trying to deal with coronavirus. And now we're going a step further because the US, the UK and the Canadian security services are all saying not only are APT groups attacking and trying to get vaccine information, we can now point the finger firmly at the Russians.
And why would they do this? Is it just about getting information?
I suppose it's very naive to say that it's only Russia that's doing this. We know from other research from the private sector, from cybersecurity companies, that there is evidence to say that China is also probing away, trying to get any vaccine information from countries. Iran is doing the same. North Korea is doing the same. So it's the usual suspects. But what we're seeing here is the Russian state particularly seem to be extremely, in the words of the NCSC, aggressive. And the Cybersecurity Centre and others have pointed towards a group called APT29, known as the Dukes or Cozy Bear. This group are known to be funded by the Russian state. So they're extremely rich in terms of the resources they have. They're probably working in an office block like a normal 9-to-5 job, and they're paid by the Russians in order to try and get ahead in vaccine research. This is according to the three national security services that we're hearing from.
And how do you defend yourself against these kind of attacks?
That's part of the reason why the NCSC and others are putting this out there. They're saying to the likes of Oxford University, Imperial College London, Stanford in America, all these top universities that are researching vaccines, they're saying to them, as well as others, look, we know that the Russian intelligence services are trying to get your information. Please be more vigilant. And it is about vigilance. It's about training your staff. For example, the researchers in these institutions, they need to make sure that if they see an email that looks suspicious, they don't, for example, click on any links or download any dodgy documents, because often that is how they get a foothold inside networks.
Cyber security correspondent Joe Tidy. Meanwhile, the British government says it believes Russia almost certainly attempted to meddle in the general election here last year. The statement followed an announcement that a report on Russian interference in British politics would be published next week by a parliamentary committee. Here's the British Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab.
We're in a position now to say that we believe, we know with reasonable confidence, that Russian actors were involved in trying to interfere with the 2019 election, principally through trying to spread, amplify online illegally obtained leaked documents relating to the UK-US free trade negotiations. There's a criminal investigation ongoing, so I can't say too much more than that. It is important to wait on the specific attribution, but we will reserve our right to take appropriate measures when we have the conclusion of that investigation.
The Russian Foreign Ministry has described Mr. Raab's statement as ambiguous and confusing. I got more from our correspondent, Rob Watson.
I think three quick points on this. I mean, the first is this is the first time any British government has made quite such a direct allegation of Russian interference in a UK election. The second is the particular nature of these allegations, which is to essentially say, look, the Russians were trying to help our opponents, the opposition Labour Party, by getting out a document that was helpful to them, they would say in the campaign, highlighting the possibility of American interference in the UK's healthcare system. And then the third point, I think, to make is that there's absolutely no evidence either way that any of this made much difference to the outcome of the election.
Why make this statement now, though, when we are expecting a report on Russian interference in British democracy next week?
Well, Valerie, the British government is being accused of skullduggery over exactly that, the timing, which has created a lot of suspicion. I mean, essentially, you know, the suspicion that the government is doing this as a diversionary tactic is for the following reasons. Number one, the British government has been in a horrible muddle these last few hours over trying to figure out which MP should be in charge of the intelligence committee which produces this report. And secondly, the suspicion is that the government wants to divert attention away from a report that may well highlight links, for example, between wealthy Russian oligarchs and the Conservatives, and may well look at alleged illicit Russian support for Brexit during the referendum campaign, a campaign, of course, for Leave led by the current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. So, you know, the allegation is essentially, look, the government wants all of this because it can get everyone sort of weary and fed up with Russian spy stories and say, hey, look, you know, we Conservatives were the victims of the Russians as well.
Have we heard from Labour on this? After all, they've got a new leader, haven't they, Sir Keir Starmer, since the election?
Yes, absolutely. But the former leader, Jeremy Corbyn, he said, look, this is the idea that we were doing Russia's bidding, not true. It's a diversionary tactic. But here, I think, is the huge takeaway from all of this. I suspect that when this report is published next week, that Britain is now such a divided country that whatever the report says about Russian interference in the UK democracy, I guess half the country that voted Remain and don't like Boris Johnson will say, well, you know, you can tell there was something dodgy about that referendum and Boris Johnson's election victory. And people that voted to leave and who like Boris Johnson will say, well, the other lot, they're just bad losers. They didn't like losing the referendum.
Rob Watson. Brazil has now recorded more than 2 million cases of coronavirus. It's the worst hit country after the United States. More than 76,000 people have died. Our South America correspondent Katie Watson reports from Sao Paulo.
We lost a patient of 37 years old.
Dr. Fernanda Gulinelli walks me through the intensive care unit of Emilio Ribas. This is one of Brazil's top infectious diseases hospitals. When the pandemic hit, they placed their patients in other institutions and started catering entirely to those with COVID-19. It doesn't look like a typically packed public hospital. Every patient in this unit is in isolation, and between the room itself and the ward is a chamber with a sink where the doctors put on their gowns and masks before entering.
They're coming in worse situation. Sometimes you just can't do anything anymore. Very hard because we lose people, sometimes more than one of a family.
It's a brutal job, says Dr. Fernanda, who's on shift with her husband, Dr. André, also an infectious diseases specialist. They enter a room to check on a patient. You can see him heaving as he tries to breathe. He's lost the use of a lung and they're unsure whether he'll survive. Every day she has his 9-year-old daughter on the phone.
We have to deal with the family pain. They're not here for them when they're dying. We're trying to do our best, but sometimes it's not enough.
4 months in, they're exhausted, and there's no end in sight.
I feel safe here, more than I'm outside.
Really?
Really?
Really? I feel safe than outside. Because of people not distancing, people not taking care.
It's a comment that reveals a great deal about what's happening in Brazil at the moment. President Bolsonaro has shunned social distancing and refused to wear masks, despite them being mandatory. The death toll is huge, yet shops, malls and restaurants are reopening. People here say it sends the wrong message. Dr. Jamal Suleiman is another of the doctors in the team.
He is irresponsible. He is a person without empathy. He's incompetent. We have every day 4 airplanes crashing. And he said, it's not my problem. So, it's my problem?
It's hard for you.
Yeah.
At Vila Formosa, Latin America's biggest public graveyard, I meet Adenilson exhuming a body. With more and more people being buried, space is at a premium. So those whose loved ones died more than 3.5 years ago are being asked to collect their bones. Adenilson pulls out a crumpled jacket and shakes out the bones inside, placing them carefully in a plastic bag. It's the only thing we gravediggers are afraid of, getting COVID, Adenilson tells me. But someone's got to do it. His uncle was buried here just a few weeks ago. A childhood friend also died. Adenilson says his job nowadays also extends to awareness training and psychology, speaking to families who've lost loved ones to tell them to stay home and stay safe. For those who've passed, little chance to rest in peace in these challenging times.
Katie Watson in Brazil. The Vatican has published new guidance instructing Catholic bishops on how to report cases of sexual abuse of minors by priests, even if local laws don't demand it. The church has been the subject of sexual abuse scandals for years. Here's Gareth Barlow.
The 20-page handbook, or Vademecum, issued by the Vatican, aims to provide clarity for bishops dealing with reports of sexual abuse by clerics. Previously, alleged cases of abuse had to be reported to church superiors, but the Vatican required its members to follow local laws on whether or not they should report alleged abuse to local state authorities. The new guidance changes that. Clerics must now report any cases, regardless of what local legislation requires. The document also details what constitutes a sex abuse crime, what investigations must take place, and possible legal avenues to prosecute abusers. Last year, Catholic bishops requested the Vatican draw up the document, which will be sent to all dioceses, to provide greater clarification on due process and responsibilities. For decades, the church has been beset by child sex abuse cases and attempts by some to cover them up. In 2018, Pope Francis condemned the atrocities committed by abusers, and the latest guidance is a further step towards reinstating confidence in the church and protecting the safety of minors.
Gareth Barlow. A court in Saudi Arabia is reported to have ruled in favour of a woman's right to live alone without getting the permission of a male relative. The verdict has been described as historic. Our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston reports.
Local media reports said charges had been brought against the woman in this case because she had been absent from her family home without her father's consent. Her lawyer said the court's ruling in his client's favour showed that it wasn't a crime for a woman to choose to live separately. Deeply conservative Saudi Arabia has traditionally given fathers and husbands sweeping authority over their daughters and wives, but recent reforms have allowed women greater freedom in important areas.
Alan Johnston. One of the side effects of climate change and rising temperatures could be heat stress when the body can't cool down and suffers a range of serious health problems. Among the most affected are people in developing countries working outdoors, such as farmers and builders. But medical staff wearing personal protective equipment as they tackle COVID-19 are also suffering. Our science editor David Schuchman has been investigating.
Okay, so I've just put on all my PPE. I put on my cap, my goggles, my N95 respirator, my gown, as well as my gloves. I feel a little bit warm because the evaporation of my sweat is reduced by this impermeable gown.
Dr. Jimmy Lee is about to enter a COVID facility at a hospital in Singapore. It's a temporary structure built for the crisis and doesn't have air conditioning. So after a few hours in the tropical heat, he's dripping with sweat.
Inside, I'm actually drenched in sweat. So this makes working in these conditions quite challenging. It can affect your morale and also your thought process. It can be very challenging to maintain your concentration.
The risk is that hospital staff keep working and then collapse from what's called heat stress. That's when the body can't cool down. Usually, sweating gets rid of the heat. But when there's a high level of humidity with a lot of moisture in the air, the sweat can't evaporate, so the cooling process doesn't happen. Rebecca Lucas, a specialist in heat stress, says faintness and cramps can lead to more serious effects.
As you get hotter, those symptoms become more severe, so you can become disoriented or confused. Those cramps can increase in intensity. That feeling of nausea can become quite powerful. And when you get to a heat stroke scenario where it becomes clinical, in some situations parts of the body will shut down.
Brick workers in India labour under a blazing sun. And as with millions of people in developing countries, they're facing even tougher conditions to come. That's because climate change is leading to higher temperatures and greater humidity. Dr. Jason Lee of the National University of Singapore says heat stress could become the next big threat after the coronavirus.
I see this pandemic almost like a full dress rehearsal for what is to come, to know where this climate change, global warming will be a bigger monster, that we really need coordinated efforts across nations to prepare what is to come. If not, you know, we are seeing right now, if you're not prepared and you prepare too late, then there will be price to be paid before you recover.
Luckily, there are ways to help. Fans to keep the air moving, resting in shade, having plenty of water. Rebecca Lucas says that simple steps make a real difference.
If you could take a complete break, sit down and rest, take on some cold water and be seated in the shade with some airflow through and allow yourself some recovery during that work day, we are seeing that have a significant impact on the health of the workers that we're working with.
Back in the hospital in Singapore, semi-frozen drinks help the staff to cool down. Many other employers don't think about the impact of heat on their workers. But there's growing evidence that they'll need to as global temperatures rise.
David Schuchman reporting. Also in the podcast.
It was deemed necessary to cull them because of fears that the mink could actually give the virus back to humans.
Tens of thousands of mink on a farm in eastern Spain are to be culled after they tested positive for COVID-19. Yes, tests revealed that 80% of the animals which are farmed for their fur had been infected. I heard more from our Europe regional editor, Mike Saunders.
93,000 of the animals are going to be killed. It's at a fur farm in a village called Puebla de Valverde in Aragon, which is east of Madrid. And this came to light in May when a worker's wife tested positive for the coronavirus. And subsequent tests discovered that her husband and six other workers were also positive. And so they carried out a series of tests on the mink. And as you say, progressively, it was found that up to 80% of them were positive. It was initially hoped that perhaps the mink could be isolated and it would die down. But with that level of infection, it was deemed necessary to cull them because of fears that the mink could actually give the virus back to humans. And Aragon is one of the worst affected regions in Spain, in fact, for incidence of coronavirus. So they didn't want to take any risks.
And this isn't the first time it's happened with mink, is it?
Not at all. It's happened in Denmark and also in the Netherlands, where 24 fur farms with mink have been deemed to be infected, and culls have been going on there since June. Now, the agricultural minister, Carola Schouten, has written to Parliament twice to warn of possible infections of employees by the mink. And in fact, several academic institutions in the Netherlands are looking into this very transmission from animals to humans question, because obviously it's quite a worrying vector of transmission if that's the case. The WHO, the World Health Organization, has also said that it is quite possible that these Dutch cases were the first instances of animal to human transmission. Now, the researchers have already found that the virus is present in the dust inside the barns where the mink are kept, but not necessarily in the air outside. But they broadened their research to look at other animals, and they tested 11 cats on one farm cats, and three of those tested positive as well, suggesting another possible means of transmission, which again is worrying.
Yes, because I mean, everyone listening to this will want to know, is it usually humans to animals rather than vice versa?
That's right. In fact, the Belgian health authority back in March did signal a case of a cat that caught the coronavirus from its owner. The owner had been in northern Italy, gone skiing, and had caught the virus there. As you remember, that was a real hotspot right at the beginning of the pandemic. And so it was worrying that this cat had caught it. But I think it's the possibility that animals can then pass it back to humans that has really got the researchers worried.
Mike Saunders. Since the pandemic struck, many people around the world have lost their jobs and are looking for work. Those scrambling for vacancies, when they're advertised, are trying to stand out. In recent years, personal videos have become a more common part of the recruitment process, particularly for big companies who often need to sift through lots of applications. A startup firm called Slink even wants to make personal videos made by applicants on an app on their phone the very first thing employers look at when deciding who to hire. But is video as fair as the old-fashioned CV? Dougal Shaw reports.
I'm very passionate about travelling and learning new languages.
And I also love baking, and I have my own food blog.
I'm a people's person and like to form strong, long-lasting relationships with clients and colleagues.
These are all extracts from short video pitches made by some recent graduates looking for work. They were recorded on an app called Slink, a platform that wants to shake up the recruitment market. The majority of job applications these days are done online, but still with an emphasis on the written word, the CV, questions and covering letters. The team behind Slink think younger job seekers in particular express themselves better in video. I caught up with co-founder Faiza Jami in their London office.
We wanted to create something for the Snapchat generation. Through this video CV, an employer actually already tick marks a lot of things. So for instance, your tone of voice, your confidence, how are your communication skills?
Fun fact about me is I have like 100 different hobbies.
It's free for candidates to upload their short videos. Employers pay for the ability to see their full details and perhaps take things further. Most employers using this are from the tech and creative sectors. Employers like Matt Sedgwick from Key Focus Consulting, who explained to me the appeal of video in a video call.
We do get high volume of CVs coming through and high volumes of applicants. Now, the frustration is they all look very similar. and hard to differentiate, using the Slink platform, we're really able to get an understanding of exactly what the person is like.
Video may be a convenient and in many cases cheaper way to filter candidates, but it does raise issues about discrimination, something I put to Saiful Jami from Slink. Obviously, with a video, you can see skin colour, you can hear somebody's accent. How does your platform deal with that?
If an employer is making a judgment on video CVs then and there, it is up to the company's auditing team to ensure that the diversity is fair within the organization.
According to employment lawyer Sarah Evans of JMW, employers do need to be on guard with video when it comes to unconscious bias and discrimination.
The Equality Act applies to however you're dealing with an applicant for a job. And the particular benefit of CVs is you can anonymise individual details and protected characteristics such as gender, race, religious belief, if you're wearing something that shows that.
I'm hungry, I'm furloughed, and I'm chomping at the bit. So take a chance on me.
For the new generation of graduates that grew up with YouTube and Instagram, video making may come naturally. It may even be a skill that gives them an advantage in an increasingly tough job market for everybody.
Good luck. That was Dougal Shaw there. Cricket's governing body, the ECB, has excluded the England cricketer Jofra Archer from a test match against the West Indies for breaching coronavirus protocols. Both teams have been adhering to strict health and safety rules to protect them from the disease, as Henry Moran reports.
The ECB have said that Archer stopped at his home in Brighton en route between the first test match in Southampton and the second game at Old Trafford. There are strict protocols in place for players' travel, and Archer has accepted he contravened the guidelines, saying he fully accepts the consequences of his actions and apologises to all those inside the bio bubble. Archer will now have to isolate for 5 days and is required to take 2 coronavirus tests, both of which must return negative before he can return to England duty.
Henry Mora. Scientists who've studied the closest pictures ever taken of the sun hope they'll help solve a mystery that's puzzled them for years, why its outer atmosphere is hotter than its surface. A European Space Agency probe, which was built in Britain, captured the images at a distance of 77 million kilometres, about halfway to the sun from the Earth. Razia Iqbal spoke to Caroline Harper, who's the head of space science at the UK Space Agency, who told her about the equipment on board the spacecraft.
There are 10 scientific instruments on board, some of them to take images of the sun and some of them to analyse the streams of highly energetic particles that pour off the sun at high speed, the solar wind. So there are instruments on board that will analyse the solar wind as it streams past the spacecraft as well. And there were technological challenges associated with developing those instruments and the spacecraft, having to cope with being so very close to the sun. The spacecraft, for example, has to cope with being very hot on the side facing the sun and freezing cold on the backside facing away in the shadow. So there were lots of technological challenges that had to be got over before this mission could get to the point it's at now.
So in terms of miles, tell us about the closest ever vantage point, because that's what we're talking about here. But how close?
I think I'm supposed to talk to you in kilometres, actually.
OK, you tell us both then.
So the pictures that we're talking about today were taken from 77 million kilometres away from the sun. And that's a lot closer than we've been able to take pictures from a spacecraft before. And in fact, we're going to get even closer in. So Solar Orbiter will take the next 18 months or so to get into its fully operational scientific orbit. By the end of 2021, it will be able to get even closer to the sun than it is now. And so at the closest point, at the end of 2021 and going forward through the next decade, it will be approaching the sun at a distance of 43 million kilometres. And, you know, people might be listening and thinking, well, that's a flipping long way. But it's very close to something as hot and energetic as the sun.
And just describe the images and what they're telling us that we didn't know before.
Well, the thing that the researchers are getting excited about, particularly with the images that we've got today, is these, they're calling them campfires. So they are small, and I use the word small advisedly, they're small solar flares dotted around the surface of the sun that we didn't know about before because they're small. In fact, they're probably about the size of the UK each, but relative to the normal size of a solar flare that we're used to seeing from the sun, they're very small. And we don't know what they're doing. There is one theory that they could be contributing to something called coronal heating. So this is where the outside layer of the sun, the corona, is, for reasons we don't understand, much hotter than the other layers. Okay. And they think these campfires might be contributing in some way to that.
Caroline Harper, Head of Space Science at the UK Space Agency. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and I'm the host of The Comb, a BBC World Service podcast.
The Comb, no.
The Comb. Now, The Comb covers Africa. Obviously, Africa is a very big place.
Omar, you've been looking into this, right?
Yes, I have been. And honestly, Kim, it has been a big eye-opener.
But what we really want to tease out are some of the more universal themes that you find across Africa.
Do you take the well-paying job that you hate, or do you take the job where your passion lies?
As well as the themes and stories that are specific to certain countries.
You should see me in the public transport, tears streaming down my eyes.
And when you bring those two things together, the universal and the specific, you end up finding something quite unique that I think would appeal to listeners, not only in Africa, but around the world.
I still had that sense of pride to say I've made it.
That's The Comb, C-O-M-B, from the BBC World Service. Just search for The Comb wherever you get your podcasts.